There we go.
Yeah.
Good afternoon, colleagues. With that gavel, I have just convened the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development for February 18th, 2015. We are gathered today for the purpose of a public hearing and public testimony on Senate Bill 5520, the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. And Mr. Marks, lead us off before we get into the, we're going to finish the slides that we had remaining, Mr. Burns. Talking about our favorite agricultural substance. And so let's take off where we left. And then we do have people signed up to testify, so we'll move through expeditiously if you don't mind.
Yeah. Okay, co-chairs and members, for the record, I'm Tom Burns, director of the marijuana program through the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. As I recall, we were on slide 15. If you're following online or up here, it has not gone live yet. There it goes up. So one of the things we were talking about, some of the considerations that the agency is working to craft the budget for this program. One of the key things is Measure 91 does not give OLCC any peace officer authority, unlike its alcohol side. The commission has formally adopted a resolution asking the legislature to give it peace officer authority. Because this is not 100% just an enforcement action of going in and seeing if they're doing something wrong, there's also the need to look at the books to double check that they've got the amount of product in, that there will also need, on law enforcement or our inspectors will need some financial investigations. We need to partner with all law enforcement. There are funds available for local law enforcement. It's 35% of the revenue goes to local law enforcement, 10% to state police, 10% to sheriffs, and the 15% to chiefs.
Colleagues, I have asked the agency to bring us a more detailed expectation of the revenue piece of this, and to find out when the front end loading catches up with repaying the fund, and so we've asked for that level of detail.
We can do that. We need to support law enforcement efforts to drive the illegal product inside the regulated system, and we need to create some very bright lines between where our authority ends, law enforcement authority starts, local government authority starts, DUI, so that everybody knows who has what responsibility and who's going to be responsible for what portion of this. And now, there it goes. Preventing diversion. The Cole memo is very clear that they want to know that there is no product leaking from the regulated system into the illegal market. We're proposing a seed-to-sale system. This is a system that is used in both Colorado and Washington, as well as a number of medical-only states. It is a system that is very robust. You plant a plant, you report to us you planted that plant. You lose a plant, you report to us you've lost that plant. You tell us what you've harvested, you tell us what you've sold, you tell us what you made. It is a chain that follows the product from the seed all the way to the ultimate sale to the consumer.
And who is developing the enforcement mechanism? So if I have five plants eaten by gophers and I do not inform you, what happens?
We would be enforcing that. We have the ability to go in and do an audit at any point in time. If we discover there's shortages or overages, we can, if we have law enforcement, peace officer authority, seize overages. If we have shortages, they better tell us where it went. If it's not satisfied, we can impose sanctions. We can pull licenses. We have the authority to be as heavy-handed as we wish to be.
Mr. Burns, I want to be blunt. There are many agencies that have that kind of regulatory authority, and they don't exercise it very well. DHS, with their licensure of assisted living, they've let terrible situations develop and have not gone out. Tell me something that reassures me that your oversight is going to be vigorous and that it will be geographically equitable.
Co-chairs and Senator Johnson, I don't know how to answer your question personally, except to say that my neck is on this line. This is the one that's, I'm the one that's helping create this program. I think if the chair was here, he would say that the entire commission's neck is on the line. We want to see this program work, and if it doesn't work, It will be our responsibility, and we will know very quickly if it doesn't work.
One last thing. It is going to be driven by you, not complaint-driven, where my neighbor's looking over the fence saying she had 12 yesterday and she's got 4 today.
It can be both. One of the things I learned on the medical side is that oftentimes those who are licensed and working inside the system will start diming on those who are not. And
diming, what a lovely phrase. I haven't heard that in ages.
And they come forward very quickly to say, he's cheating and I want you to go in and close him down. And
thank
we
you.
Did close him down.
Thank you. Please continue.
I just want to let you know we estimate this cost to be about $1 million to build this system. We are in the process of crafting an RFP. We have asked for funds out of this year to allow us to sign that RFP before the beginning of the new biennium. The system will, as I said, track it from seed to sale. There are a number of vendors that did this. We put out an RFI to try and learn what was going on in the marketplace and had 23 legitimate companies come forward and say they thought they could build this based on what we were asking for. So we're now going out for an RFP, and we'll intend to release that mid-March and sign a contract by mid-May.
Thank you. Representative Newman.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Burns, do we have any data back from Colorado or Washington on their seed-to-sale of their enforcement of it and how successful they're being with that?
Yeah. Co-chairs and Representative Nierman, both states say that within the seed-to-sale system, they're relatively comfortable. That's the words that I hear from both states. The problem with both states is they have a large operation of marijuana that is functioning outside the controlled system, and that's where they're having serious problems of driving those outside processors and growers into the controlled system.
Follow-up, Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Burns, don't you think that we have that in Oregon also? We have, we have the medical system, but we have a, an underground or a black market, gray market, whatever. Aren't we going to have those same challenges here?
Yeah. Co-chairs and Representative Nierman, absolutely, which is why we need to partner with our law enforcement friends, why the agency needs peace officer status so that we can actually take actions to drive the people inside the regulated market.
I have a question.
Representative Whitsitt.
In my district, which is Rob Patridge's district, as you know, we have a huge cartel influence from the Mexican drug cartels running up Highway 97. They branch off I-5 and come straight through Klamath County, the full length of it, and also go east into Idaho. And so it's my understanding there are at least 22 separate cartel operations going on in this state which haven't even been addressed but which are acknowledged by the Department of Justice right now. And so I don't know how we're going to get the cartels under control even if we manage to get the citizens or the growers here in the state. And so I think you're going to have to work with the Department of Justice, and they are going to have to address these cartel, and it's not 22 separate cartels, it's 22 distributions or whatever. So maybe you could address that a little bit.
I just want to say for the record, if you'll excuse me, this flurry of staff activity was indicating that the recording system was briefly inoperable.
He said we can keep going. They're doing a backup recording.
Okay, and so I just wanted to make sure that we acted appropriately to preserve the record. Part of your question may have gotten lost, Representative Whitsitt. If you could just rephrase her question as you begin your answer, and with apologies to anybody that's listening to this, it appears that we were down and now we're back up and operating.
Co-chairs, Representative Whitsitt. What you've asked is what to do about the drug cartels that are coming up through Highway 97 off the I-5 corridor from California. And the need to work with DOJ. We absolutely understand that. That's why we are looking to actually embed within the agency a state police officer to help us partner with that law enforcement so that they can reach out to the DOJ. I will also tell you one other thing. In Colorado, they have seen a significant decline in cartel marijuana operations. That the marijuana is so readily available now because of either the home grow or the recreational grow that the cartels have given up in Colorado on marijuana. They're bringing other products in, but on marijuana they have stopped bringing it up from Mexico into Colorado.
Okay, follow up. One of the issues that we have down there is they're buying up ranches. And we know this because there was a double murder cartel hit about 7 miles from our house on a ranch that was purchased ostensibly as a horse farm. And instead, they were growing marijuana there. So they are actually not just hauling it up from Mexico, as I'm sure you know, they are actively growing it in parts of Oregon and California, both on legal and illegal, on federal forest land, and also on these private ranches that they're buying up. So, I mean, it's huge. It's absolutely huge, and it's not just a transport, from Mexico up. It's here, they're growing it, they're distributing it, they're packaging it right along all those southern counties, basically, with California, and I think some of the eastern counties, too. So I'm sure you're aware of all of that. Okay.
We are co-chairs and Representative Whitsitt. Yes, we're aware of it. State police is aware of it. Local law enforcement. We all have to partner to address this problem.
Thank you.
Oops, I'm sorry. I got ahead of myself. I'm not quite sure how to back up here. there we go. Impaired driving. This is something else that the Cole memo directly asked us to address. The law, Measure 91, does not have a specific limit on marijuana intoxication. Colorado and Washington have settled on 5 micrograms. If there are 5 micrograms in the blood, that is considered impaired for driving purposes. We are required as an agency to do the research and the analysis and come back to this body, the legislative body, in January of 2017 with some recommendations. In order to do this, we will be partnering with the DOJ Criminal Investigation Division as well as the state police, and we'll be building the data sets necessary in order to show pre and post what is going on in our highways around the use of marijuana. Program creation challenges. So we've talked about how we are going to implement this program, but we still have some creation challenges. First of all, OLCC did not submit an agency budget. It was a budget that we worked with DAS on as part of the initiative process and the ballot titling process. The governor's budget is based on what really came out in July of 2014, prior to the passage. We don't know how many licenses we're going to get after January. We are uncomfortable with revenue projections that we've seen. We just don't know what they are. We won't know them for sure until we have a harvest and we start selling product into the system before we know what the revenues are. And credible projections and cost revenues will be difficult until calendar year 2017. On the revenue collection, I'm not saying anything that you don't know, but it is $35 per ounce at the point of sale from the grower to the next licensee. It's $10 per leaf. Leaves are used to make extract, and it's $5 for the immature plants. On the license fee side, it's $250 to apply, and the license fee is $1,000. I would point out to you, in case you're interested, the medical marijuana license fee is $4,000. In Washington, they have the same license fee and application fee numbers as we do. In Colorado, it depends on the license. They range from a low of $2,200 for their labs to a high of $5,000 for their retail outlets.
I have a question.
Representative Whitsitt.
Why is ours so low then?
Co-chairs, Representative Whitsitt, it was set by the initiative writers.
Okay.
And in the initiative itself.
But we do
follow-up, Representative.
We do have the opportunity in this body to change that, do we not?
Co-chairs and Representative Witness, yes, you do. It is a statutory initiative.
Okay.
We also think it's important to understand some of the variables that go into this. We don't know what the impact on local bans might be. Local governments can opt out and ban all marijuana retail. All marijuana businesses from their jurisdiction. We don't know what the number of licenses are. We don't know what the consumption level is going to be. Perhaps the entire medical market is, in fact, the consumption level, and there will be some people transferring out of the medical into the recreational, and there is no expansion in the marketplace. We just don't know. We don't know what the market price is going to be. If the price gets very high, people will move back to the black market. If the price gets very low, growers may not want to grow. Obviously, what the legislative body and the joint committee do will impact this. What's a home grow going to do? If I can grow my 4 plants, maybe I'm not even going to ever consider buying it at the retail outlet. We don't know the market for edibles and what edibles might do and whether there's discussions about delaying edibles. And then the whole question of the relationship between the recreational market and the medical market needs to be addressed and resolved in order to fully understand what the revenue projections are going to be.
Mr. Burns, going back to the medical and the recreational, would it be safe for one to assume that there is no distinction between the quality of the plants that come into one of those two streams versus another?
Co-chairs, Senator Johnson, it depends on who you talk to. If you are a patient, the patients will absolutely say to you that they do not trust what the recreational product will be like, that it will not be something of the quality that they think they need in order to serve their medicines. If you talk to the growers, their comment is, we can grow for patients as well as recreational, and we will get quality product to both. So I can't, in all honesty, answer your question.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
Licensing fees. We were trying to come up with some numbers, and we just took a raw estimate of how many different licenses there might be in this state based on Colorado's experience. And again, I keep using Colorado because Colorado has a well-established medical market, just as we do, and we think that's a better way to look at the current market than to be looking at Washington. We estimated there would be about 1,200 total applications received for the market. That could be low, that could be high. I personally think it's very low, but we started with that as to sort of try and build some sort of revenue projections. If that is in fact the right number, we will receive $1.5 million in the first calendar year, all of 2016, and then that drops a little bit in 2017 to $1.4 million on just the license applications and the fees for the licenses and the application fees. The Legislative Revenue Office created some estimates that were used both on the ballot as well as in creating the GRB. That was $16.7 million in total revenue. That includes not only the license fee, but the tax fee. That's for the entire biennium. There were other independent estimates made. They were not built around Oregon's fiscal process or our budget process. There was a study for Harvard that said they thought the tax revenue for this product in Oregon would be about $70 million a year. We had Equal Northwest, which was actually advising the campaign on what the revenue might be. They said there would be $38 million in the first full year and $78 million for the first biennium. We put this up only to show you the wide disparity in estimates on revenue. We just don't know.
Mr. Malik is sitting in the front row, and I view him as a target of opportunity. Mr. Marks, could I ask you to step back, and Mr. Malik invite you up? The professional staff was kind enough to ask Mr. Malik to join us, and given his expertise in revenue, I would just invite any of your comments based on what you've heard or any of these slides. Let's start with Representative Reed first, though.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just a general question, probably something you're already going to cover, but I'd be particularly interested in what you might share around the differences in methodology that produced these wide ranges of numbers.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, Mazen Malik with Legislative Revenue Office, glad to be with you. But most of these, Representative Reed, most of these estimates come very much from the same place. We're talking, we've been studying this, and I've been studying this issue for the last few years. The funny thing, one of my daughters asked me how long you've been studying it. I said, long time. She said, since college, Dad? at any rate, our estimate about a few years ago was about 2 million ounces as a market in Oregon. So if you just take quick math and say 2 million ounces, multiply them by $35, you get 70 million. So that's where the idea comes. So basically saying, that estimate says, if you today able to shut down the black market as it exists and turn it all together into a legal market that is taxed for every ounce, you'll get $70 million. And that is reasonable if you can do it. However, it doesn't seem plausible that this is going to work, because the black market existed first. So you're introducing a new regime of regulation, a new type of taxation mechanism that is trying to compete, and primarily in our estimates and our way of looking at things as economists, it is competing on price, because it exists already, so it's not asking for permission to introduce the product to the market. So it already exists. The demand is already there. The supplier, or who can supply it, is almost a binary function. If you are at a certain price level, they will come and buy from you. When you're not, they'll buy it somewhere else, your friendly neighborhood type of supplier. Our
Representative Witt's not a veteran of the Revenue Committee. He doesn't have the same experience with this.
Long time ago. So our estimate took a stab at the price, and you see, I've sent you probably, or sent Michelle the copy of our report. We've attempted to establish a price where the regulated market would be able to start at. The regulated market, by definition, could probably not start at the same level where the unregulated market is. The regulated market needs to comply with certain basic issues, such as they would have to pay taxes, they'd have to pay worksman comp, they'd have to pay rent, they'd have to pay electricity, they would have to pay all kinds of things that unregulated market does not have to comply with, which in essence brings you to a certain level of estimate. And we've gone through a whole bunch of scenarios to see how these different effects will impact the price. And then at the end, there is the impact that we are not necessarily able to solve, which is the federal tax code, the IRC tax code of 280E implication. So that's when you're able to deduct your costs as the cost of doing business. And this is not applied in this case because of the federal sanctions of the product. So having to put all these things together, we think that the price of a regulated market would at least start about the 300 level type of price. That is significantly higher than where black market price should be, or is today, as I'm told, at 180 or so. So with that, we estimated with the price elasticity that we compared to from different studies and compared to other substances such as tobacco and so on, to get us to about one-third of the market going to the legal market immediately. So that's a good amount of chunk of the market to go legal. Then we estimated also, based on different studies and what the fall of the stigma, if you will, and the new type of regulated, what the induced demand would be at about 3.9 or 4%. And then we looked at what Colorado is looking at the tourism, because it seems a lot of the Colorado experience is experiencing a huge tourism kind of industry with the marijuana, and we saw about 42% of their product being due to tourism. We were able to, of course, adjust that to what we have in our neighborhood. Our neighborhood with Washington and California having viable and very strong medical programs as well as legal in Washington that is not exactly the same as you would have in Colorado. Just that ability, and we're looking at about 19-point-something or 20% increase in the legal market from the legal base into coming from tourism. Well, then we put all these things together and we looked at the different issues and what could also be a matter of costs for collections and costs for enforcement of the OLCC. We saw that, I think we have it in the report, at about 7-point-something million in the first year at implementation and starting to see the revenue coming in fiscal year 2017 at the $16 million. And then you take all these expenses out and you should end up with a net revenue amount of about 9.3 or so on the net to be distributed to the different uses that is specified in Measure 91. Those are the common school fund and so on. Now, there's a lot of things that are not exactly 100% clear or, straight to the point with Measure 91. but there are things that you have to make assumptions to. I think some of the things that were not clear even to the writers of Measure 91, I think they didn't want to say the common school fund. I think they wanted to say state school fund. So it goes immediately to the school formula kind of thing, rather than go to the common school fund and then get a, like 6% of that every year and so on. That's not where they wanted it to go, probably. That's my assumption. And I assume a lot of the things that might not be where they thought it is, as I see OLCC's estimates, they are talking about a lot more growers than processors and distributors or wholesalers. And in the taxation theory, if you're looking at the most efficient way to tax, you need to as less taxpayers as possible. That's obviously not the growers in this case, at twice or three times as much. So there are many things that could be improved, if you will, in this picture. However, if you look at the picture as we were looking at it before the time of Measure 91, as you know, by statute, Legislative Revenue Office is required to help the Price Tag Committee kind of look at this estimate. So this is what we looked at that time. And we can understand where the other things or the other estimates are coming from. And those assumptions probably are not what might transpire over time.
Thank you, Mr. Malik. Colleagues, any questions? Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Malik, correct me if I'm wrong, but in the medical marijuana, since marijuana is illegal federally, they don't put their money into banks. Mr. Burns is nodding. Is that true? So you're dealing with an all cash kind of business there. Does that impact your ability to collect taxes? And will that be a problem in the future on your ability to collect taxes?
Co-Chair Johnson, Representative Nierman, I think it probably would hinder tax collection somewhat. I don't think it will prevent it. It will be a lot easier, of course, if you have the ability to do it through banking. It seems like the other states are having to do it in a cash type of transaction. That might have effect probably some on the timing and some on the security. That will increase your costs of security. So by essence, it will be reflected in price too. And if you have to hire protective services to deliver your taxes and keep your money in the cash, that by essence increases your costs. After all, the banking system, although it charges you fees, part of the services that you receive for those fees is the security and the mobility of your money. And if you don't have that, you would have to charge your customer too.
Follow-up?
And I'm asking you for a guess here, so just have at it. But the fact that it's a cash business, how does that impact the ability to collect taxes? I'm not talking about your ability to collect taxes. I'm talking about compliance. So are we talking about 80% of the people pay, or 20%, or 50%, or just? And I know you probably don't know that number off the top of your head, but you probably have a better guess than I'm able to do.
Co-Chair Johnson and Representative Newman, the assumption that we made in the estimates and the assumption, why we made this assumption, because we were led by the language in Measure 91 to assume that you're collecting taxes at the highest level, which is the grower's level. So if you measure that on different ways that we collect taxes, we collect in the state many taxes in addition to the obvious ones. Most of those are on a very high level. We don't collect on the consumer level. So if you do that, you end up with about 150 payers or so. When you're dealing with 150 payers, it's a lot easier to control and limit the impact, if you will, than when you're dealing with millions, like the income tax, if you will. So the cash nature of the business would probably have an impact, but as the smaller the payers that you have to deal with, the less that the impact would impact your revenue stream.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Malik? Mr. Malik, I know how busy you are. We're going to thank you for being here, and if you want to go back to your office, please feel free to go. But
thank
we
you.
Appreciate your insight into the revenue question. It's one that's weighing heavily on lots of people's minds. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Director, welcome back. And Mr. Burns, we'll ask you to continue. Yeah.
Co-chairs, and moving on. So the revenue distribution is shown on here. It's 40% to the Common School Fund, 20% to mental health, alcoholism, and drug services, 35% total law enforcement, 15 state, 10 for each of the local law enforcements, and then 5% for prevention.
It would be very helpful if when you come back or if you could get to the professional staff and they'll distribute to all of us, given the numbers that you just shared and the numbers that Mr. Malik has shared, would it be possible to monetize this? There it is.
Co-chairs, this is from the GRB, and again, it started with the assumption of how much money we would get in the current year, $330,000. Obviously, we're over that by $250,000. We're asking for another $750,000. The two fiscal years there, total cost for the program between now and June 30th of 2017 is $7.1 million. $16 million in revenues, $400,000 in license and application fees, which we think is very low with all due respect. We think it's going to be significantly higher. Anyway, you can see the net is about $9 million. There is an assumption in the GRB that there will be funds transferred to ODA for some of their work in order to help the fact that this is a crop that is growing and they need to be involved in this. And then you can see based on this what the distribution is to each of the funds.
Okay, it begs the obvious question, if the revenues don't come in, what's the fail-safe?
I am unemployed.
Okay.
I will leave that to the director.
Because, Mr. Director, I can already imagine that cities, local law enforcement, are thinking about, you know, the interior configuration of the new police cars, and what happens if you don't come through?
Madam Chair, I have been saying that I would be very conservative if I was sitting in the city and expecting the money, particularly out of this startup biennium. Once we put the system in place, we know how many licensees we have, you would have more confidence. This is also an issue for our payback of the alcohol liquor fund, as you well know. The good thing about that, or a feature of that, is that we have said we expect to pay that back before we make any distributions. Paying that back does go to the locals, but it'll come on the alcohol side when we do that.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Burns, soldier on.
So one of the things as we're building the budget is to understand some of the impacts that the marijuana program will have on the OLCC alcohol program in administrative areas. For example, human resources. We're going to be adding about 15% new staff to OLCC. We may need a new human resources person in order to handle that. Financial services. We're going to have to build a tax collection, a tax payment, if there is a system. If there's no banking, someone's going to have to sit there and count the $100 bills that are brought in. We hope banking is resolved. The procurement questions, obviously, we are adding to the workload on the alcohol side. The facilities. We are going to add 28 staff or some similar number. We don't currently have that space within the office on McLaughlin. We will either have to expand that or rent or find some other location for these people. Information services, just the usual demand. Contested case hearings. To the extent that somebody is unhappy with the decision we make, we have to cover the cost for contested case hearings, all of which are additional burdens that may end up on the alcohol side or on the overall agency side.
I'm going to ask the professional staff to flag that as something that clearly has fiscal implications. If the OLCC is picking up the contested case hearing costs of a new program where undoubtedly there are going to be disappointed people, do you have any estimate of what impact that's going to have on contested case?
Co-chair is Senator Johnson. We don't. I can tell you on the medical marijuana side, we had about 10% of the applications contested. They were not happy with the decision we made. Of those, I'm going to say 10. So we had about 50 cases that actually were contested. Of those, about 10 actually reached a point where we were in front of an ALJ and defending our positions. That's the only example that I can give you on the marijuana side.
And just as an aside, what'd your scorecard look like in those contested cases?
100% on our side. Thank you, DOJ.
Okay, please go on.
I want to spend a moment talking about what we need now between between now and July 1st when the new budget goes into effect. As we noted in December, the E-Board gave us authority for $583,000 in expenditure level. That's four staff covering the legal costs to help build this program, covering our listening sessions, and the first, at least, internal work of building the seed-to-sale system. We have a current request in for $750,000. This represents the seed-to-sale RFP, where we will need to hire some staff immediately to help implement that in order to meet the requirements of the CIO's office and the LFO's data processing people. We may need to sign a contract that would require some upfront in advance of the end of the fiscal year. So we are estimating that's about $250,000. We're asking for five additional staff between now and that we can hire now so they can start work immediately on some of the work we need to do immediately. That's $156,000. And then one of the things that we realized, we woke up one day and said, we're going to have legalization in 3 months, and somebody ought to start explaining to the public in Oregon what that means and talk about maybe some health and safety issues and some legal issues. So we're asking for $350,000 on education. Each of these are laid out in the next couple slides. The seed-to-sale system, as I said, is a $250,000 request. It will track in the current biennium. It is another $600,000 to $700,000 potentially in the 15-17 year. Track all marijuana within the licensed commercial system. It will meet the Cole memo. As I said, we received 23 RFIs, responses to an RFI when we sent out. We've been coordinating with the LFO and CIO's office to meet the stage gate requirements that are in place. We have been working with them, and we have met all of those so far. It is our intent to release the RFP on March 10th. And in 60 days to award it. And again, if the terms of the contract for the award requires at least a down payment, we will have to pay that. And again, all this is because the system needs to be operative by January 1st. And rushing a data processing system is never a good idea. And we are rushing it, even if we start today.
I'm going to ask you a question that carries over from another Ways and Means hearing that just concluded, and that is how well the CIO, the Chief Information Officer, and the Legislative Fiscal Office are communicating with each other in terms of telling you what the elements of the stage gate review process are. Are you finding there to be a good communication flow?
Yeah. Co-Chair Senator Johnson, absolutely. We are meeting with them either by phone or in person almost on a weekly basis. They have reviewed every document. They have been in every meeting. We are having constant meetings with them. I've not been in all those meetings, but I hear nothing but good comments back.
Thank you. Go ahead.
The rebalance for staff, staffing request between now and the end of the biennium. We need a compliance specialist to help us start building the requirements around how we are going to enforce this. What does an inspection look like? What kind of staff will be needed to do that inspection? So we want to bring in a compliance specialist to work with us as we move through the crafting of the rules so that they can develop a position descriptions so we can start hiring those staff in the fall. And to have them on board in time to start accepting applications in January. We need a data analyst to start doing things like what is the revenue projections, what are the questions around the DUI that needs to be addressed, how many, what's the impact on our healthcare system if we start discovering that there are problems with the way marijuana is handled in the body, the underlying data analysis that is necessary to understand any new program. And so we're seeking a data analyst. The next two have to do with the seed to sales system. Again, if you're building a new IT system, you need a project manager and a business analyst. I define the project manager as a person who carries the whip, and the business analyst is a person who will translate geek to marijuana and marijuana to geek. And both of these need to be on board immediately, and the CIO office agrees with that. And then, quite frankly, if I don't have and the team doesn't have some administrative assistance help, I think we're going to lose the staff inside OLCC. We have become a major burden on them in just answering phone calls and processing paper and getting payroll done and all the administrative processes and getting reports to you and everything else that needs to be done. We need some administrative help. Moving on to the issue of public education. As we said, marijuana becomes legal in the state on July 1st. We need to have somebody, it may not be us, but we are bringing it to your attention, the need to start building an education to the general public around the whole issue of marijuana. What is legal, what is not legal, what is safe, what is unsafe, improve the understanding of the recreational program, improve compliance with the laws, minimize potential negative impacts across both the personal grow, the personal lack of personal consumption, the education around edibles. The last thing we want is somebody to start consuming edibles, either homemade or made in the recreational side.
Senator Monroe.
Should have happened before November.
Yeah, no kidding.
Co-Chair Senator Johnson, Colorado, and couldn't have agreed more with that statement. And then, obviously, it provides avenues for public for the citizens to get additional public information. Again, 350,000 is the number that OLCC has done for similar alcohol-type outreaches. Are we the right agency to do this? That's a policy question, but somebody needs to be doing that.
Will you go out for an RFP, or how are you going to define the universe of folks that are capable of producing a campaign like that?
Madam Chair, that's largely in your hands in working with us and approving this request. We can contract out, we can RFP, we can take it to public health. We really want to provide and put a marker and opportunity for you to make a decision about how you'd like to proceed.
Thank you.
So that's the that's the current biennium getting us to June 30th. As of July 1st, we will be in a new fiscal year, so we need to build a new budget for you. The $7.1 million that is in the governor's budget is a number that we will work within. It is designed to have 28 positions, 20.5 FTE. It's staged hiring. Obviously, we've already got four people on board. We're asking for five more between now and July 1st. We'll need to start bringing the inspection staff on board. Come sometime in July or August, we'll start needing to bring the tax collection staff on board. We have to build the rulemaking outlet. outreach process. We have to continue to maintain and implement the seed-to-sale system. And then I want a job. So that's what the line manager on there is. Just in full interest of full disclosure, the seed-to-sale system we estimate is in the range of 800,000. That's a number that both Colorado and Washington were in the ballpark of. Perhaps it will be less, perhaps it will be more. It depends on what the RFP. And then there is an ongoing annual maintenance of about $300,000 to
maintain
the system.
Can we just lift anything that they have successfully done, or do we have to start with a blank piece of paper as we are wont to do?
Co-Chair Senator Johnson, we are lifting great volumes from both of them and dropping them into our RFP.
Thank you.
Some other issues, the Department of Justice consultation. This is a very complex measure. It does not impact just OLCC and just 91. As you start looking at this, you have water issues, you have local government issues, you have law enforcement issues. We are spending close to $25,000 a month in DOJ bills. I will say that I think they are very good expense, but we have to be able to budget that. As I said, we don't have staff within the McLaughlin office to handle don't have facilities to handle the 28 new staff. We may need to bring in experts like a quality assurance expert on the seed-to-sale system. We need the help on building the laboratory process so that we are assured that the products are, we know what the potency is or the product is safe. And then the GRB does assume funding of some positions over at the Department of Agriculture that has to do some of the licensing as well, both the potentially commercial kitchens, the grows themselves, and the scales that are used to weigh the product. Timing on revenues, we've
Mr.
talked
Mr. Burns, to, let yeah. me stop you for just a second. Will that be an ongoing activity? I know Department of Ag certifies scales all the time for a variety of different things. So if I am a retailer or a producer, can I expect to have a visit from the Department of Ag to ascertain that my scale is accurate?
Co-Chair Senator Johnson, absolutely. And in fact, on the medical side, we required you to have that certification before we issued you a license.
Okay.
I think it's only fair that the consumer knows what they're buying, particularly when you're buying at gram level. That's, you blow on some of these scales and that is more than a gram. So we need scales that are clearly certified.
Thank you.
The timing of revenues, as we said, expenditures began in December. The seed-to-sale system we need in place by 2016. We think license revenues will start coming in March of 2016. Tax revenues in July to October. And then other personnel. We've laid this out in sort of a timeline here that I think is a better chart to look at. The e-board startup, which we talked about, with $583,000, is we got that in December. We had the office set up and recruitment for some of the just general supplies and services. We need to build a license, an application system, and we're working with NICUSA around just the application service. This is the cost that is will occur after it's built sometime in the next biennium. The seed-to-sale tracking system, we need authority to release that and to sign contracts before the biennium. We need to build in the staff and determine what those are. And then go live. We estimate that about $260,000 out of the current biennium. The rules process is an advisory committee that is working now. It will be adopted in by the commission in their November meeting. And then we will immediately, I guarantee you, start rewriting the rules because as much as well as we try, we will not get it 100% right. And so we will go through a permanent rule as well as additional rules.
Mr. Burns, forgive me if I'm asking a question you've already answered. Your rule development by an advisory committee, who all is picked for the advisory committee and who is the appointing authority?
Yeah. Co-Chair Senator Johnson. Each agency can establish its own rules advisory committee process. The current plan is to ask the commission to pick certain types of individuals, local government, law enforcement, parents, consumers, growers, and then Executive Director Marks would solicit nominations or applications for that, and he would make that appointment sometime in late March.
And right. Mr. Marks, I would like on the record for you to opine on how you intend to get balance and adequate stakeholder representation on that advisory group.
Well, Madam Chair, there's a few ways to do that. Obviously, we expect to have all levels of law enforcement, local governments present. We probably need a balance of the industry community from indoor, outdoor processors, retailers, to help inform our rule development. And then we would probably add to that mix members of the public. I'm not sure what our count on the total committee would be. Beyond that, there are issues within development of the rules that are going to be sort of stakeholder consensus-based processes. We can appoint subcommittees within the RAC. We can add additional members when we do that. There will be some areas that are highly technical where we'll want to appoint people with technical acumen to help us develop the rules.
In addition to law enforcement, I would respectfully ask that maybe you consider somebody from the courts or the DAs.
Yeah.
Okay, Mr. Burns.
Oops,
we got Representative Whitsitt, and then we got Representative Reed. Nope, we got Representative Whitsitt.
Yep. Okay. As you know, several of our counties in Southern Oregon do not have adequate law enforcement already. I mean, we can't even run police on the roads for a number of hours of each day. Our jails aren't open, or parts of our jails. I don't know how we are going to expect our law enforcement to take on something like this when they can't even handle what we've got already. I mean, I don't know what is the answer for communities, Curry County, Josephine County, Klamath County, that are under such duress already by not having any money for law enforcement. How are we going to address that?
Chair Johnson, Representative Whitsitt, it's one of the reasons that our commission has asked for peace officer authority so that we have at least the ability to do some criminal citation within our enforcement within the system. But you are correct. There's no magic here except for the distribution that would come back. And as we've warned, it won't be much in this biennium. It will be better in 17-19 if we get this program underway, but there's no panacea here for additional enforcement beyond that.
Thank you. All right, bring us home, Mr.
Okay.
Burns.
Well, the total expenditure is $7.1 million. We expect some application fees and some revenues. You can see where we expect those to start coming in. This is just an estimated timeline today. Obviously, if they get into this, it'll be even more. And for those of you who are getting beat up and want to send your constituent someplace, marijuana.oregon.gov is the public web page where everything you want to know about marijuana but we're afraid to ask is posted. If it's not there, call me and I will find out why it's not there. Our email is marijuana@oregon.gov, and we have a phone number that we can accept phone calls for. Feel free to send your constituents to those numbers. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Colleagues, any questions of Mr. Burns? All right, Mr. Marks, you want to wrap up your part of the presentation? We have four people that are on the witness list, so if someone has been moved by the spirit of testimony, I would ask you to make it known to the staff so we can add you to the list.
Madam Chair, just to say that, you know, we're in a build of the budget process. We are working very closely with LFO and with DAS to construct what will be our eventual budget. We haven't presented you a clear budget today, but you've seen the building blocks here. The resources that we're asking for in the short term were yet to be determined, but we are moving up some of the planned expenditures that are the one-time capital investments in this ask for the remainder of 15. So we appreciate your consideration of that and your indulgence of working with us as we build this budget during the session.
Thank you, Mr. Director. Ms. Deister.
I would just offer for subcommittee members that the Legislative Fiscal Office recommendation, when it does come forward, it is my expectation that this will probably be one of the later budgets to go, because you will have the joint committee that is making policy around this
joint
area. So all of those decisions are, as we've heard, likely to have an impact on the dollars spent and what is needed to get this budget up and running. So The Legislative Fiscal Office will take in as much of that information as possible when presenting you with a recommendation. The other thing that I would offer is that there are other opportunities within the biennium, for example, the February 2016 session, to come back and refine some of those figures as well. So this will be a process, I think, and it'll be an iterative process as well, I anticipate.
All right, Mr. Marks, your colleagues, thank you. This is the OLCCC. When does that happen?
You know, we appreciate the stage gate process, but if you could shoot the alcohol side of the budget out quickly, that'd be great. Thanks.
Thank you very much. All right, colleagues, there is no one from farther than 100 miles, so I'm going to take testimony as they signed up, and with that, invite Mr. Brown and Mr. Lohman to come forward together. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair, co-chairs, and committee.
You know, I've done a very bad thing. And before you begin, I forgot the chief financial officer. Bad on me.
We can say.
So would you guys move for just a second? And Mr. Ball, with apologies, I just got so excited talking about marijuana that we got right to the testimony.
Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dustin Ball, and I'm with the Chief Financial Office. Let me get this up here, and we'll get moving. I have a brief presentation for you guys this afternoon that will give you a high-level overview of the governor's budget for the Liquor Control Commission and what is to come. There's a lot of moving parts in this. We understand that the joint committee is meeting and potentially making, there could potentially be some statutory changes out of that to Measure 91 that may result in the need to make additional adjustments to the governor's budget for this agency. But in summary, there were three emerging issues that we addressed and we looked at and took into consideration in developing the governor's budget for the Liquor Control Commission. And those were the needs to modernize, provide repairs to the current facilities of the agency, and to address the ballot measure 91 that was passed by voters that brought marijuana regulation underneath the Liquor Control Commission. We also took into consideration the 10-year plan and how this agency relates to the 10-year plan, specifically the economy and job side. The agency provides a lot of resources and supports many industries in Oregon, the independent liquor agents, distilleries, breweries, and wineries. We also looked at the public safety element. The agency does strive for the safe, responsible sale and service of alcohol in the state. This slide here will give you a brief history of the agency's expenditures over the last few biennium. On the far left is the actuals from the 11-13 biennium. The middle is what's projected in the current biennium, and on the far right is the governor's budget that was proposed for 15-17. And you'll notice the uptick in FTE, that is specifically related to the marijuana regulation program. Also, you'll notice on the far right, the other funds non-limited on the top, that's the bank card fees. And I'll talk about that a little bit more in the next slide. What I want to highlight here is you'll see that about 36% of the agency's budget is operating, its operating budget. And what that is really the cost of the people and the cost to run the agency. These other two categories, bank card fees as well as the agent's compensation, those are really outside of the agency's control. Bank card fees, as we talked about earlier, were the treasurer negotiates the rate, and then a consumer chooses whether to use a credit card or not in the store. And so it's a factor of those two components that the agency then pays the vendor. Agent's compensation, this is to compensate the independent liquor agents throughout the state, and they use this money to essentially run the independent businesses, pay their employees, and this approved, or the governor's budget maintains the average approved percentage of 8.88% of sales. In terms of the revenues that flow into the agency, We have the next slide. I'm just going to jump to that. Gives you a little bit more of a picture. Shows you the breakout of the revenues. You see here that the vast majority of revenues from the agency are derived from the sale of distilled spirits. That's the liquor sales. On the top is the governor's recommended budget. The bottom is the current biennium projections. You'll see the privilege taxes are projected at just over $36 million. In here, we also have the 50 cent per bottle surcharge. That was, as we talked about on 2 days ago, extended by the commission, and the governor's budget does assume that the legislature will direct 100% of those proceeds to the general fund as opposed to the standard distribution formula. And also on here in the governor's budget for 15-17, you'll see there's a figure of $16.4 million for the marijuana income. Prior to ballot measure 91, the agency had one distribution formula that it used to disperse the agency collected revenues from the various sources, paid its cost to operate, and then dispersed the remaining funds. On the left side here, that was the original compensation formula. Now under Measure 91, we're going to need to track those revenue sources separately, and those the alcohol-related revenues will flow through the existing distribution formula, and the marijuana-related revenues will flow through the new formula that does not put any funds to the general fund. And then the agency talked in detail on the investments in the current biennium. So I'm going to move through these very quickly. The governor's budget does make a number of investments to update and modernize the agency and its infrastructure. We do support the training, peace officer training of agency staff to meet the requirement of Senate Bill 1528. We established a new marijuana regulation program, which is required under ballot measure 91. We moved the bank card fees from a limited expenditure to a non-limited expenditure. Again, assume that the legislature will direct 100% of the 50 cent per bottle surcharge to the general fund. And then we also support the establishment of a new fee for new license applicants or applications where they're transferring ownership. And I would be happy to address any questions if members have them.
Thank you. Colleagues, any questions for Mr. Ball? Mr. Ball, my apologies. Thank you. All right, now we'll recall Mr. Brown and Mr. Lohman, and I want it noted for the record that Senator Hansel is testifying on a bill. That's why he's absent. Good afternoon, gentlemen. I'm sorry for the inconvenience.
Co-chairs and committee members, my name is Steve Brown. I'm a agent at Salem Battle Creek, one of the newest stores in the state, store number 1198, and Lincoln City North, store number 1091. And hopefully I'm here to actually testify a little bit more positive on ways to bring in more revenue for the state. First of all, I'd like to give some history on the base compensation and the liquor store conversion that you heard about the day one of testimony. Agents have identified the OLCC non-exclusive formula for compensation as a disincentive to invest in store modernization, which is one of the points the DS just brought up, that we feel modernization is an important step forward for the state of Oregon to continue to collect revenue. Agents in exclusive contracts selling only distilled spirits now want to take advantage of an opportunity to move to a non-exclusive contract, which enables them to acquire a license to also sell beer and wine. 19 agents have made the conversion over the course of 2 years. Some of these agents were participants in the OLCC pilot program of four stores allowing such conversions. These initial conversions have proven to be successful models for increased alcohol sales of 2 to 4% above the current trend, and are accompanied by significant investment in equipment and store appearance through remodeling. Non-exclusive conversions have largely been seen as improving customer service and customer convenience. Typical remodels or relocations include improvements to facilities, layout redesign, installation of coolers for beer and wine, fresh paint, flooring, changes in lighting, installation of tasting station, and in some cases, a popular growler fill station. As agents have made the conversion to non-exclusive, their base compensation rate is reduced. In the past, the concern addressed by the reduced formula was that such conversions would create a lack of focus on distilled spirit sales. Additionally, the logic was that contract agents would bolster their earnings by the sale of beer and wine, offsetting the reduction in base compensation. The new logic is based on the experience the OLCC had with the pilot program. Agents that have converted to non-exclusive have not seen a reduction in distilled spirit sales. To the contrary, spirit sales have generally, as I stated before, increased 2 to 4% above the state current trend. While conversions to non-exclusive store remodel or store models have been a sales and consumer success, the base compensation rate reduction is continuing to deter increased store conversions. It was originally believed that somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 stores, 20 or more contract stores, would convert, but the formula became a disincentive. Last week, we polled all exclusive states or stores in the state via SurveyMonkey and asked two questions of these exclusive stores. Do you plan to convert from an exclusive to a non-exclusive this next year? Yes was 8 agents. No was 73 agents. Then we ask agents if there was no commission rate decrease from exclusive to non-exclusive, would you consider converting your store? All of a sudden, it flipped. We had 72.5% of the agents that were polled, which was 58 agents, say yes, that they would invest in their stores by remodeling and changing to a non-exclusive. The no were 22 agents. Agents in the OLCC are working to create a better business model that supports sales, modernization of retail systems, and investments into the facilities. And I want to take this time to actually thank Director Marks. It's been a breath of fresh air to work with the agency this last year in ideas that we can modernize the stores using the store owners' investment and ways that we can create additional sales for the state of Oregon. Holding the base rate flat would help to alleviate the risk and return on investment when stores converted. Agents believe the legislature and the OLCC can solve this problem by targeting funds to maintain the base compensation rate, even if exclusive stores convert. The targeted incentive solution would be the legislature should direct OLCC through a budget note to hold base compensation rates harmless for future stores that want to convert. The legislature should provide equity to agents that have already converted as part of the pilot program and restore them to the higher level of base compensation. To achieve the same, the legislature should provide an additional $612,000 in budget limitation to OLCC to restore rates to pre-conversion levels. The legislature should direct OLCC to report to the legislature, one, the number of additional stores that convert in the 2015-17 biennium, two, the experience of the distilled liquor sales by agents that convert, Agents in the OLCC are also directed to report to the legislature on the total dollars invested by agents in conversions during the biennium.
Mr. Smith, as long as you have all that written test, or Mr. Brown, as long as you have all that written testimony, could you make it part of the record?
Yes, I would be happy to. Thank you. In the past, agents have unsuccessfully sought additional across-the-board compensation. This proposal is a new approach that holds promise to increase compensation and return on investment to improve the customer experience and satisfaction and to improve returns to the state. The addition of $612,000 is strictly aimed at these specific outcomes. And I just want to say again, the return on investment is huge.
I'm going to ask you to begin to wrap up. We've got others.
Okay. If we end up looking at the store owners, the 58 stores, $50,000 per store is about the average. I've converted both my stores. That's almost a $3 million investment by the store owners. What would be the rate of return that I believe in a biennium that we would get in sales? I would say conservatively the rate of return to the state would be $9 to $10 million in a biennium for $612,000.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Lohman.
Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, and members of the committee, my name's Tim Lohman, for the record. I currently own McAdam Liquor in Portland and Murray Shoals Liquor in Beaverton. A lot of things that I was going to say is repetitive, so I won't say them. Other than the fact that I am an agent that will convert from exclusive to non-exclusive if I can retain that $15,000 a year. I figured it out as a small businessman. I would have to sell $5,000 worth of beer and wine monthly just to break even, and it's probably not a break-even point after you pay the extra manpower and the electricity and so forth.
Thank you for your very brief testimony. I appreciate it. And Mr. Brown, again, I'm going to respectfully ask that you put your very comprehensive testimony into the record. Thank you. Colleagues, any questions for these two gentlemen? Okay, there being none, I would next call Mr. Basler, please. Welcome.
Chair Johnson, Chair Gomberg, my name is Joe Basler. I represent Oregon AFSCME. We represent the workers at OLCC. I just want to come and quickly say we support the agency's budget. I just want to make it very clear the work on the warehouse to improve its efficiency doesn't actually have any loss of FTE, but instead reshuffles the shifts in which they ship out liquor and will actually make it a lot more effective for our workers. We've talked to them. Right now, they're spread over a lot of shifts. If they can do this upgrade, they'll be able to make it just more efficient. A lot of times, you think unions, they don't like modernization, but this actually is a good system. And we've also had meetings with them about the new staffing needed for the marijuana. There's still so many unanswered questions about out there, but we think that the agency has come with a very prudent sort of solution in trying to figure out these right decisions. But that's pretty much all I have. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, any questions for Mr. Basler? Thank you. Next, I don't mean to mispronounce your name, but Ms. Dietzel or Ms. Dietzel?
Dietzel.
Well, I'm not real formal.
Would you, but we're going to make you be formal. Would you state your name for the record,
please? My name is Dolores Dietzel, and I am a medical marijuana program cardholder. I have fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue and a bunch of other stuff in between. I am disabled per Social Security. I have been first, when I was first diagnosed, the first thing that they wanted to do for my pain management was put me on methadone. I refused. I absolutely refuse. I will not do that to myself. I use Vicodin, and I use marijuana. My doctor is retiring, and I'm having a difficult time finding a doctor that will allow me to use my marijuana along with my medicine, because they don't want to do that. They don't want to cross that line. But I also want to state how important it is that you not combine the medical with the recreational, because it's my medicine. I use it for that. It's not recreational, and I do not feel that I need to go to a liquor store to get my medicine. Granted, we grow, we have a garden, and we're legal. So, you know, I don't want to go to a liquor store to buy my medicine. That isn't where you get medicine. I'm not a drug addict. I smoke marijuana. I use cannabis. And I am very proud of that fact. I have researched, and it is healthier than 99% of the drugs that are on the market. I don't know what else to say. Yeah.
Well, that's fine. Thank you very much for your testimony. Colleagues, any questions?
I would love to answer questions.
Regrettably, we don't have any for you. Thank you, though, for making the effort to come and testify.
This is very important. I'm scared. I'm scared I'm not going to be able to find a doctor to care for me. And it's just... I'm 58 years old. You know, I can't, well, I'm disabled. I can't go work. I can't do things. But I know what work has worked for me, and I
do have a question for you. How long have you been a participant in the medical marijuana program?
Since 1999. And my rheumatologist, I have records that indicate that I have never abused my pain program. I have never done. I'm a patient. I'm disabled, and I need my medicine. It creates a calm in my body that just regular pain pills just don't take care of. It doesn't take that edge off.
Thank you very much for making the effort to come and share that important information with us.
Well, I just want y'all to really take to heart that I'm just not one person. I'm 100 people in your counties, in your districts. I'm the little old lady down the street. I'm the farmer that, you know, just got a bad back. I'm the person out here screaming, you know, and I don't want the medical and the recreational combined.
Thank you very much.
Thank y'all for hearing me.
Thank you. Anyone else that didn't get onto the sign-up sheet that wishes to offer testimony? Okay, there being none, Ms. Deister, will you give us should I go ahead and close the hearing, and or do you want to comment on the door still open?
You are not scheduled to meet tomorrow, so that's what I have for you. Next week, we will start with Housing and Community Services.
Okay. Colleagues, you've heard that. The data will be up on OLIS for perusal in preparation for the committee. And so with that comment, unless there is any thoughts from the committee, Mr. Co-Chair? Okay, there being none, I'm going to close the public hearing and the public testimony on Senate Bill 5520 and declare the meeting adjourned. Senate Bill 5520 and declare the meeting adjourned.